Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the gentleman nerds. The gentleman nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemannerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Lobot Lounge. We are gathered here today to talk about films that may or may not have been good, but somehow influenced us. At least we were about to talk about films that may or may not have been good and have influenced us. But unfortunately, today, November 14th, 2018, we are all in the mind to talk about Stan Lee. Mr. Stan Lee passed away, and we at the Gentleman Nerds decided to forego our initial talk to really discuss what Stan Lee meant to us. We want to really get into the idea of our tribute here to talk about Stan and to really share maybe some personal stories. Maybe we've met Stan Lee. I don't know. I've never met him, but maybe some of the other nerds have. And we want to talk about some of these things and what Stan meant to us and what he meant to the community at large. Gathered around the table, enjoying a drink or two or three or four, is Mark Finn.
Face front, true believers.
Aaron DiRive.
Excelsior.
And I am Joseph Otinos, your host and emotional touchstone for this, our very special impromptu, as Stan would love it, Stan Lee tribute of the Gentleman Nerds. Glasses up for Stan.
Here, here. Stan. Yeah. Here, here to Stan.
I gotta say, we knew it was coming, everybody. We knew he was elderly. We knew his health was failing. It's not a shock. But it still kind of takes you out, right?
Oh, yep. Totally.
I mean, it's for me personally, it was like Bradbury passing away. Mm-hmm. I thought, how can the world continue without Ray Bradbury? How can the world continue without Stan Lee? It's a weird thing to think he's not with us.
I feel kind of doubly cheated because, you know, we lost Steve Ditko just a few months before. And so essentially Spider-Man's parents are gone. He's an orphan again, you know?
Why did you do that to me?
I'm sorry. That's harsh. I had heard recently that he was having trouble with his caregivers. And of course there was discussion of money being mismanaged and misappropriated and all that. And it occurred to me that, you know, this is, this means that he's probably losing some of his faculties.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a guy that, was working into his 90s, you know, again, we should all be so lucky, but I was, it was still a little unexpected. And I'll tell you why. This is so apropos. This weekend, Kathy got caught up on the Marvel movies that she had missed this year. Yeah. She had seen Infinity War and she hadn't seen Ant-Man and the Wasp. And so we watched both of them. And of course, there's cameos in both. And so it was on my mind and Marvel Cinematic Universe was on my mind. And I was literally just sort of, I'd just shown Kathy the trailer for Captain Marvel and wondered, you know, kind of idly, I wonder where Stan's going to be in this one, you know, cause you know, he's going to be there. And so I was really, you know, when it came over the wire and I saw it, if you'll give me a second.
Yes, please.
As a member of Generation X, as a latchkey kid, you know, I don't have a lot of memories of my father. The first 10 years of my life, he was around, but he wasn't really around. I always think about that line from the third Indiana Jones movie where Sean Connery says to Indiana Jones, "You left just when you were becoming interesting." And that's kind of true for me. I all the memories of my dad are post divorce when he realized that I wasn't going to be around forever. And so most of my images of masculinity, and what I gravitated towards, I found in media. And in the 1970s, it was all TV. My grandfather watched James Garner, and I thought, well, Jim Rockford's probably somebody I should pay attention to.
I would love Jim Rockford as a buddy or a dad.
Right, exactly, yeah, right? And so there were, you know, most of my masculinity was parroted back to me from popular culture. But Stan, to me, because he was on TV all the time. He was on kids shows. Was on TV. The Kids Are People Too was a show that was on. And he walked, you know, it was a thing where he walked on and he had the costume Marvel characters with him. And, you know, he was an actual person. You know, you read him and you saw him. And to me, he was the fun uncle. And so one of his gifts was his ability to talk to everybody and feel like he's only talking to you.
Yeah.
And that's why it's such a personal loss for so many people, because in some ways Stan was there when our real family failed us, and the family that we find in our friends and in the things that we love and the things that we care about they're no less real, even if they don't really exist. And so Stan feels like a member of the family because he's always been there for us. Mm. So anyways, I apologize for going long. But
No, you're good. You're good. It was a nice joining of the universes for me. Reading comic books as a kid and knowing that Stan Lee, his voice, his presence was there. Whether it was X-Men or Iron Man or Thor or the Hulk or the Fantastic Four, or Daredevil, Doctor Strange, Ant-Man, whatever it was, when you're reading a comic book and you're flipping through it and suddenly there's a picture of Stan Lee advertising, you know, subscribe to Marvel Comics, Uncle Stan Says So. He's wearing a Christmas hat during the Christmas episodes.
That's right.
He's got the Stan soapbox in there and he's always, you know, Excelsior and he's talking about whatever he wants to talk about. He was a presence for me. And literally, ladies and gentlemen, when I read comic books as a kid, and even, you know, to this day, I will read every single page. Advertisements, comic pages, everything.
Yeah.
I will read everything. It's an experience for me. It's like watching a television show verbally in my hand. So I pause to break from the story and read about how the Hulk saved the world with Twinkies. It's okay, you know? That's a good thing. I like that. I like it, you know? But Stan was overall, he was kind of the overlord of that universe for me. Yeah. And it was easy. It was so easy to tie it all together because Stan, the man, Lee, you know, what's it, Friends of Old Marvel, Foom. Right.
Oh, Foom, oh yeah.
Right, Stan was there. That was his thing. Aaron, tell us about your Stan stuff, man.
Well, I mean, of course, I started reading comics at a very young age. I didn't really have, you know, sort of an idea of who Stan was, even though, you know, he would always present the comic, this is Stan Lee, and, you know, presenting the Fantastic Four and all that. And, of course, I knew his voice from the cartoons that I would watch. But what amazed me, and of course, at the time, I didn't know that he was like a cheerleader, right? He was like the definitive cheerleader.
Yeah.
And anything that Stan started hawking, I want to listen. You know, what's this guy selling? Because I like what he's selling. But it wasn't until later that I understood how involved he was in the creation of all of these characters. And that's, you know, that's truly when I was like, wow, this man. Because at first he's just, you know, he's a glorified carny. But I don't mean it as an insult. I mean, he is like P.T. Barnum to the nth degree, you know.
Oh, yeah.
This man.
Oh, yeah.
Can get out there and with his charm and his smile and that great voice of his, you know, you're riveted, you know, you're 13, you're 14, you're riveted. So for me, it was Stan was the cheerleader. He was the guy that would always encourage me to watch this show or pick up that comic or read this particular series of issues and such. And so I love that about him. And I think and later on, of course, and we'll get into this with the discussions between, you know, Jack Kirby and him and who did what and all that kind of stuff. Even Jack Kirby even admitted in several interviews that, you know, yeah, Jack Kirby created a lot of these characters and did these stories and this kind of stuff. But, you know, if you've ever heard of or listened to people who've interacted with Jack Kirby, he was a very quiet man. He was a very humble man. He was not the kind to go, you know, sort of tip, you know, tap dancing into a room and listen up, folks, you know, that's not him. Yeah. So I argue that Jack Kirby would never have been Jack Kirby without Stan Lee.
You got to have the argle bargle, as absolutely, my good friend Mark Finn
absolutely.
Says.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no way. We just got done watching The Incredibles 2 again. I wanted to see it after we'd seen it open in the theater. And in there, there's, you know, the brother and sister character who run this company. And he introduces his sister and just like, you know, well, I'm the brains, right? I'm the inventor. I make all of the tech. And the brother kind of like, yeah, but I sell it, you know, you think, oh, well, he's not really. No, he is. And she even says, he's so important. And Elastigirl says, no, are you kidding? What he does? You can invent the most amazing thing in the world, and if you don't have somebody to sell it, it doesn't matter. It won't matter.
Yeah.
And so that is what Stan represented to me, like the most enthusiastic and skilled cheerleader that any line of any kind of media could ever have wanted. Yeah. You know, to be able to have 1/10 of Stan's enthusiasm and ability to sell something, because I think a lot of artists fall into the camp of the Jack Kirby's, and they're quiet and they're introverted and they're shy, and they may be brilliant, you know, whatever, writers, artists, directors, photographers, whatever, but if they don't have that chutzpah, they don't have that listen up, true believers, then, you know, that brilliance may go completely undiscovered.
Yeah.
So you know, he's the man in the spotlight, and rightly so.
You're absolutely right. And I mentioned it briefly in passing, but those of you listening to the sound of my voice, if you have not read Mark Finn's tribute to Stan Lee, you should do that, because it really does hammer it home. He did have an ability. He did have the gift of gab. And he was good friends with Troma's Lloyd Kaufman. If you can picture Lloyd Kaufman and Stan Lee in a room together.
Absolutely.
These two guys, right? To just go on, you go like, oh yeah, I see this easily.
Those guys could have powered a small city together.
Shit. Yeah, no doubt. So I can see it. And that was Stan. He was. But here's the thing that I really enjoy about that. I enjoy about Stan Lee's easy writing, naturalistic approach to his heroes. He knew that we would identify with heroes if they were more like us. So while Jack King Kirby did amazing art and Steve Ditko designed these amazing figures and these characters that we know, that we played with, that we grew up with, Stan put the voices in their throats. He put the words in their mouths, and he made them real. To me, when I think of Spider-Man, yes, Ditko, absolutely. But the fact that Spider-Man was a teenager who had problems and a sick aunt and a bully at school and couldn't, like, kick his ass and destroy the school and lift 10 tons like he really could in front of everybody, that was Stan. He created that drama that made us really appreciate these heroes on a real level. That we could all say that, yeah, I feel that, man. Every day I go to work and I wish I could do what I really can do, but I can't do what I can do because it's work, you know?
Yeah. Or whatever. And I think the what you just said about, you know, that he made these characters, you know, relatable. He made them likable. I think that was his gift. That was his gift. He knew just instinctively what people would be attracted to. He knew what people would smile at. And I think his touch is absolutely felt on Spider-Man. It's felt on X-Men. It's felt on Hulk. It's felt on every single title that he worked on. There's always a little bit of that element of, well, these guys are the outsiders. You know, they're not accepted by everybody. They struggle with issues of identity and self-worth and, you know, all these things that prior to that point, you know, heroes didn't do. You know, Justice League didn't do that. You know, Superman didn't sit around and say, "Woe is me, I'm such a lonely alien." You know, he didn't do that. I mean, later on they try to introduce those kind of elements into DC, but no, Stan was the man who brought that to comics, made them human and relatable, and nobody can take that away from him.
It's really important to note that, because it is such a thing now, and especially that DC has retconned itself, you know, 11 deskillion times. But if you take it back to the Silver Age, and again, I'm not going to disparage DC, because I like DC just fine. And
my introduction to comics was DC first. I found DC Comics before I found Marvel. So yeah,
But the guys, you know, the people over when they were redoing these Golden Age heroes for the Silver Age, they were adults who had it together. You know, Barry Allen was a police scientist. You know, Hal Jordan was a test pilot. Clark has always been a successful reporter for the Daily Planet. Bruce Wayne, millionaire. You know, they were set. You know, and the whole idea that especially if you look at there's a trifecta in the first three things that Stan did. It's so important to sort of drill down on that. The Fantastic Four, he started his Marvel Universe with a team that was public. They didn't have secret identities, you know? And right. What's interesting about that is that has become sort of the basis for much of what the current Marvel Universe kind of works off of. The Hulk, too, while not necessarily a secret identity, you know, not everybody, he's not a public figure. Later on he is, but initially the military knows who he is, you know? They know that the guy is real quick. They figure out it's Banner, you know, he's been irradiated and look, here's the problem. Spider-Man was the first one who wore the mask and had the secret identity, but it was because he was a kid, you know, and because he wanted to have this double life and be a celebrity and get the endorsement money and get paid for public appearances. And of course, you know, that of course leads to the greatest tragedy and his reason for being, is that he could have stopped the guy that kills his Uncle Ben.
Yeah.
But those three things there are, you know, these are deeply flawed people. Or not deeply flawed. It makes it sound like they're all, you know.
They have baggage.
They've all got baggage, yeah. And you know, he began to encapsulate it in the last two decades, because he kept getting interviewed and they asked him the same questions, and he always boiled it down to heroes with problems. Yeah. And so,
well, somebody there was a show. Would you tell me about this, Mark? Somebody was saying that they were comparing, you know, the DC and the Marvel characters. And certainly we're talking in this early age. It's totally – everything changes now. But that the DC characters were like stories of the Olympian gods. Mm-hmm. And the Marvel characters were stories about the Greek heroes. Yeah. And well,
that's a nice analogy.
And I agree with it completely, because, yeah. I mean, many of the Greek heroes were part god. But they had so many issues that mortals struggle with, you know, that men struggle with, that is a great distinction. It's like, well, here's a story about Apollo and Zeus and Mars and, you know, okay, great. Yeah, wow. Ah, here's a story about Jason and what happened to him. Or here's a story about Theseus. And now suddenly you can relate much more to Theseus than you can to Zeus or Ares or whoever it is. And so that is exactly what Stan did. He made these heroes not gods, not live on Mount Olympus, but walk amongst the rest of us. And it's, I mean, what a gift to the genre, gents. What an amazing gift.
Stanley Martin Lieber, his actual name, he entered into the world of comic books through the help of his uncle, Robbie Solomon, and he worked with Timely Comics in the division of pulp magazines, and he was hired by Martin Goodman's company, Timely. That Timely Comics, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, would eventually become Marvel Comics. Now, he wanted to be a writer. He always wanted to be a writer. And young Stanley made his comic book debut with a text filler, and I quote, "Captain America foils the traitor's revenge."
Yep.
And it was Captain America Comics number 3, dated May 1941. And that's where he first used the pseudonym Stan Lee, which years later he would change to his legal name. So Captain America really kind of was the first hands-on Stan Lee moment. Now, he talked about that in his autobiography, and he talked about how, you know, he used a pen name so no one would associate his real name with comics. He also invented the great Captain America ricocheting shield toss. That was Stan Lee.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
So prior to Stan Lee, Captain America never bounced his shield off stuff?
Apparently not.
Wow.
Apparently not. I mean, to be able to throw the shield and bounce it and do a damage with it, I guess that was all Stan. Who knows?
Yeah. As Spider-Man says, this thing doesn't obey the physics at all. The laws of physics at all.
But, you know, when in the 1950s, I think that after DC and the Justice League of America and everything like that started, you know, elevating their characters to the point of, well, you know, it gets a little boring. I mean, Lex Luthor is going to fly Metropolis out into the ocean with rocket packs. Well, Superman's just going to blow it back with his super breath. It's not that big a deal. Yet here we have people, as we talked about earlier, that it's got, they got really real issues. And working with Jack King Kirby, by the way, he gave him that moniker. Lee called him King Kirby. So Jack King Kirby, knighted, if you will, by Stan Lee, co-created the Hulk, Thor, Iron Man, the X-Men. With Bill Everett, he made the Daredevil. With Steve Ditko, he made Doctor Strange. And, of course, his most successful character of them all, Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Lee and Kirby gathered their new characters together and created the Avengers. And the Sub-Mariner as well.
And the Fantastic Four.
Fantastic Four.
Well, the Sub-Mariner was a Golden Age holdover. From Bill Everett.
Mm-hmm.
And so
he revived that from the 40s. That's right.
That's right. Sub-Mariner and Cap were brought into the modern day. And it is important that while he didn't create those characters, he's the one that gave them their current thing. You know what I mean? Sub-Mariner becomes a raging asshole, always talking about being the prince with the blood of impunity, whatever the hell that meant. I never knew what that meant.
The blood never of got impunity.
It. Yes. You can go look that up. It's crazy. But, you know, he makes the Sub-Mariner. And not only did he make the Sub-Mariner this arrogant snide, I mean, you know, He literally reintroduces the Sub-Mariner by having him bring a behemoth up from the depths to try and crush New York City. And what stays his hand is he catches sight of Sue Storm, hottie that she is. And and they begin an on-again, off-again flirtation that runs the length of the FF run that Kirby is on from FF4 to FF101. And that's a piece of, you know, that's Stan. That's what he did. And with Captain America, he's the one that brought up this idea of the guilt he feels over Bucky sacrificing himself. That's a major component of Captain America from the 60s and 70s going forward. There were stacks of comics that became trade paperbacks and later movies over the guilt he feels for Bucky dying in World War II while he lives. You know, I love Golden Age Captain America. It's fun because it's simple. There's nothing to it. You know, he runs in, he punches people. Sometimes they're American Nazis and sometimes they're German Nazis, but everybody gets the punch. It's only in the 60s and 70s when Cap becomes a troubled moral compass for an uncertain world.
Yeah.
That's the power of Stan Lee.
Let's bring up the probably Lee and Kirby's finest achievement in March of 1966, by my records, the Galactus trilogy.
Oh my goodness. Oh,
yeah. The Fantastic Four, starting in Fantastic Four number 48, in chronicling the arrival of Galactus. Let's talk about Galactus briefly, because I think he's one of the characters that get overlooked in the modern day Marvel cinematic universe. Certainly, I've never seen Galactus realized the way Stan Lee and Jack Kirby pictured him, because frankly, when I first read the Galactus trilogy, it terrified me.
The
buildup to his arrival, and when he did arrive, a cosmic giant who wanted to devour the planet, and his herald, of course, the Silver Surfer, truly one of the greatest marvels of all time. That whole sequence, it blew the world up. Cosmic, super cosmic. Yeah.
You know, now, however, that the Fantastic Four is back with Marvel, there are all kinds of, I mean, I'm a big watcher of YouTube, and I watch every single video that comes out, you know, with speculation about what are we going to see in the next, you know, Infinity War and all that. They keep talking about Galactus. Galactus is a character that they keep saying, you know, that there's going to be another bad brought in almost to sort of counter Thanos. And it's going to be Galactus. That's what the rumor is. I don't know if it's true, you know.
And I want to see him done the way he's supposed to be done. I don't want a cloud.
Oh, yeah, no.
A freaking giant in purple and blue armor.
whose opening line is, I hunger.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
It chills me.
I love that issue, and we all know it. The trial of Reed Richards, where he is on trial in the universe because he dared to save the life of Galactus.
I just read that. I actually got Marvel Unlimited, and I'm going through all of the John Byrne Fantastic Four issues.
I love how Galactus appears differently to every alien race. The fact that he looks like a human being wearing armor is the fact that that's how we see him.
Correct.
Other aliens see him differently. And that's amazing. That's supernatural to the point of godlike, you know. Yeah.
Make no bones about it. They say, you know, Galactus is the last surviving creature from the previous universe.
Yeah.
Who somehow made it through and was assigned, we don't know by who or what, the cosmic all, was assigned the role that he has.
Yeah.
And so he is. He's basically treated as outside of good and evil. He's not a sinister figure. He's not a hopeful figure. He is. He simply is, and he serves a function. And apparently that function is eating planets. I don't know.
And yet the Beyonder felt it necessary to put him with the villain camp. I'm just saying.
Well, and it's in the last Galactus story that Byrne wrote. He reveals that the Watcher is the one who created him. And I suspect that Galactus serves a sort of a cosmic function, whereas Thanos is imposing his will on the universe. I think Galactus is a natural consequence of the universe. And I think that's part of the reason why he's the way he is. He's not a Titan. He's not a celestial. He's sort of outside of that realm. But I think in essence, he is something like the vulture, you know, how the vulture in nature is sort of the vacuum cleaner of the natural
janitor,
world.
The janitor. Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. And I think Galactus serves sort of that function. You know, if we were doing a Marvel pantheon, he would be the god of entropy, the god of destruction, the god of renewal, however you want to,
he is a Shiva kind of figure, the destroyer, and I think he plays a very, and I love, by the way, so in the trial issue, folks, that Joseph's talking about, and I just read it, that's why it's fresh in my mind. I love that when he shows up, when Galactus shows up at the trial, and everyone is terrified, and Galactus says, of all the beings I've ever encountered, of all the creatures, of everything that I've ever known, the only one that I've called friend is Reed Richards. Yeah. And he shows up for him, and everyone's like, oh, shit!
Right? I want him as a character witness at my trial. Yes. I mean, if you guys talk to the god, I'm going to be over here. In 1969, Jesus. Stan Lee broke even better ground, newer ground, with Gene Colan, and he created the Falcon comics, very first African-American superhero in Captain America, number 117. That's huge. Stan was one of these guys that he looked at the world and reflected upon it and was able to bring that reality in 69, bring what was going on in the world into comics. Because he wanted to establish, and I really do feel this, he's speaking to a comic audience. Why not have a black superhero? Why not have him be the best pal of Captain America and have them work together? What more do you want? How does that integrate into our society of people of different races and colors and creeds and nationalities? Stan was about bringing that together. And I love the idea that he championed that. Make it easy to appeal and to affect that. Black kids reading comic books had somebody to say, hey, there's someone who looks like me, and he's a superhero.
Right. Although just because I know we're going to get a fan mail about this, the first black superhero was actually the Black Panther, created in 1966.
Oh, really?
Yes. And he appeared in Fantastic Four number 52. In 1966. Falcon then came along in 1969. And he was introduced in Captain America 117. So I want to give props to T'Challa.
T'Challa
was the actual first African American superhero.
Hey, Wakanda forever. I'm crossing my arms.
Exactly. Wakanda forever.
Well, I'm crossing my arms. I think there, I want to mention briefly, I think that there's a. I think part of that comes from the fact that the Marvel Universe was situated in and around New York City, which was and has always been a cosmopolitan center. It's multicultural, it's multi-ethnic, it is the epitome of the melting pot as we relate to it in American culture, mythology, and history. And so, for Stan to have been born and raised in New York City, I don't think these attitudes were anything new for him. But in that he chose to make a shared universe in New York City, I think it's I think you have to kind of acknowledge that this was going to happen. It was only a matter of time. And for Stan to do it, it just felt right. Just felt natural. He just, let's do this. Mm-hmm. I was touched when I saw the tweet from Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Oh, yeah.
Where he writes, Stan Lee created some of the most incredible and enduring characters of our time, and he chose New York City as the place to tell their stories. On behalf of his hometown, I want to express our deepest condolences to his family and loved ones. Oh, that's just classy. That's a class act.
That really is nice.
Yeah.
He was Jewish, correct? Stan Lee was Jewish?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think and especially coming from a medium that was pretty much started by Jewish young Jewish artists, Jewish businessmen. I think it was important to them to include characters that are not from the mainstream culture that were not Caucasian. And by the way, so Joseph, you are correct in that Black Panther was the first black superhero, but he was African, whereas Falcon was the first African American superhero. Oh. So you are correct in that respect.
Fair enough.
But
another first.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say another first that I really wanted to bring up about Stan, and this was something before he stopped writing and became publisher, because he was still writing at this time, that the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare asked him to write a comic story about the dangers of drugs. And Stan Lee conceived a Amazing Spider-Man storyline that Peter Parker's best friend becomes addicted to prescription drugs. And the Comic Code Authority refused to grant a seal of approval because of the drug use depicted in the comic. But Goodman's cooperation and said, you know what? I think you're good. The government request would give you credibility. Publish it anyway without the seal. So we're talking about Stan saying, I want to make a statement here. I was asked to write a story. This is real. And it changed the Marvel Universe. It became part of that pantheon of the Marvel Universe. We all know who we're talking about, and that's Peter Parker's best friend, Harry Osborn.
Right.
Drug use, you know, we don't deal with that in Batman, or we don't deal with that in Superman. We deal with it a little bit in the Flash. No, who was it?
Green Arrow. Speedy. Oh my God. That was not on purpose, right?
Not so. But we did a little bit of that. But I mean, we're talking about the first time that this was brought out in comic books. We're talking 1971. And that really kind of, I remember the drawings of Harry Osborn under the throes of his drugs. I remember how that looked as a kid. And I remember that it terrified me. Yeah. Of course, Harry Osborn had other problems, his father being who he was.
Yes.
But it was interesting to me, and it was fascinating, and it was compelling, and that was the point of it. It made characters that you wanted to know more about, that you cared about.
Yeah.
That was Stan. That was Stan Lee right there.
Yeah, there was a lot of concern initially because to go against the code was a big deal. You know, back then the code, it was significant because at the time you just didn't go against it. It was sort of like going to get standards and practices on TV,
right?
You know, because they were afraid it was going to open them up to just all sorts of problems. And if I remember correctly, stances, and then we ran the thing, and I think we got like one letter.
It was okay.
But it totally moved the needle. The first time they realized, oh, you know, we can do this material, and it's not going to hurt us. You know,
come on, gents, is that not the purpose of art? I mean, come on, I love this. I get so excited by this kind of stuff.
Social commentary, right?
Yes,
right?
That is why the real world. Yes, racism, that is why bigotry, art exists. This is why art exists. Yes,
intoleration, prejudice.
It he shines a light. It shines a light.
There.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up with Stan's guiding hand, and I want to say, to a certain extent, that, mind you, I was raised by very liberal parents, very kind parents, parents who had a reflection upon the world. Immigrant. My father was an immigrant. My mother, Mexican-American. I mean, I had all this going for me. But reading Stan Lee's words, I knew how wrong it was for intolerance to take over. I knew how wrong it was for discrimination and prejudice. I knew how wrong racism was because of my comic book world.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, by the way. That's the other thing I admire about Stan Lee. He knew the power of his medium, and he knew the audience, right? That's very important. He knew who was going to be reading these comics, and he took that responsibility very seriously.
Yeah.
And he knew that if he said something, if he put a message out there, if he put a character that acted a certain way out there, millions of kids would look at that and either model or learn some lesson from it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a huge responsibility. That's a really, really big responsibility. And Stan was up to the challenge and never, ever disappointed when it came to trying to teach, as best he could, trying to teach the youth of America right from wrong. And bravo for that. I mean, even that, if he did nothing else, that in itself as a legacy of what, how he helped to raise generations of kids, bravo. He's like a Mr. Rogers in that respect.
No doubt. Well, he stepped away from his regular duties at Marvel in the 90s, and he became sort of a, chairman Emetrius. He became, the spokesman for Marvel Comics. And, as a result, he received an annual salary of $1 million as his chairmanship, and he became the spokesman for Marvel. He stopped writing, more or less, but he was always there. His presence was felt every single time. He always had a point. Whenever you thought Marvel, you thought Stan Lee.
Yeah,
and true. The animated series, his voiceovers. I remember Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, Marvel's... Yeah. Comic cartoon in the 80s, Stan's voice.
Even going back to those really crudely animated filmation Hulk, Avengers, Thor, Iron Man. I mean, they were great. I remember all the little themes, Captain America sends his mighty shield.
Those who oppose the power of a shield must yield.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. All those. I mean, and by the way, so. And Mark, maybe you know more about this, but from what I can tell, it was pretty much due to Stan's efforts that kept Marvel in the other forms of media, kept it relevant,
He
kept pushing for them to make more shows about Marvel characters and Marvel titles. And
that was part of his responsibility. Yeah. Okay. Part of his annual salary, and him moving to California, was for him to press the flesh and start making those deals. And so, of course, he'd done the Hanna-Barbera stuff was the Fantastic Four is considered some of the best Fantastic Four ever. The limited animation stuff you're talking about was done by an ad agency in New York City. Cause of course, and that's why it's limited. And that's why, the voices, it was all, locally sourced.
Right.
And then it got picked up. But if you, and this is for any of our listeners here as well. If you know who Ms. Lion is, that's Stan. Basically, Stan was the guy who, when he couldn't get traction with movies or TV, he turned to animation, and because the animation worked last time, and so there's a spate of cartoons in the late 80s into the 90s that keeps that. Those franchises alive. And I can tell you, from experience as a movie theater owner, the adults who come to the movies to watch the X-Men, movies and the Wolverine movies, inevitably tell me that, when I was a kid, I watched every episode of the X-Men cartoon on Saturday morning. Those were really important, and they were important at a time when, let's face it, the Spider-Man TV show was limited. It had a special effects budget of about $39, and the Incredible Hulk had a special effects budget of $139.
Yeah, but the Hulk worked. They found a formula for that show where. All it took was, Lou Ferrigno with some green paint running around for a little while going, because really the rest of it was just, it was a drama. A drama about this guy and going through and finding his way and,
totally.
And every now and then.
That voice wasn't Lou Ferrigno.
Right.
Oh, the one going, rawr.
That was Ted Cassidy, Lurch from the Addams Family.
Oh, yeah. That does not surprise me because that
is
a deep voice.
Ted Cassidy's voice, yes, indeed. Nice. But when Stanley became that sort of figurehead, if you will, he started becoming ubiquitous in not only Marvel Comics being drawn as various characters, bartenders, guys in the street, he was always kind of there. When Jack Kirby and Stan had their falling out, Jack went to DC Comics. And King Kirby created a Lee parody named, everyone, Funky Flashman. Yes, Funky Flashman.
Oh, gosh, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah. So the Lee and Kirby had a bit of a falling out, and in a way to make Stan Lee appear as that fast-talking, you-can't-trust-him SOB, Funky Flashman was born. But in the end, I think even Lee and Kirby both acknowledged what the other one was and what they did. They both had a respect for each other in the end. And I do want to say that while people will step up and say, well, he fucked Kirby and blah, 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 and he made him da-da-da and all the rah. Yes, there was some bad blood between him. And there probably was good purpose for it. You know, nobody's perfect. And I'm not going to pretend that Stan Lee was a perfect human being.
Right.
But I think what he did overshadows his faults or his sins or his, you know, whatever he may have done wrong, choices he made that weren't right. I think that what he did for us, for the world, I'm giving him a pass on some of that stuff.
I've seen some interviews with him, and there was one where he goes on the record, you know, talking about that period, where, you know, he basically says, I didn't feel like I could say anything, because I wasn't in control of any of it at that point. Mm-hmm. And he says, I regret not saying anything. Maybe it would have helped. Maybe it wouldn't have helped. But I feel bad that Jack thought that I didn't care, because I did and I do.
Yeah.
And
no, I think I saw that. Yeah.
He
meant it. I mean, when he was saying he absolutely meant it. And I think, I mean, the big fight, by the way, listeners, is over all that Jack Kirby wanted was his art. He wanted his art back.
Yeah.
And, you know, they went back and forth and back and forth, and ultimately he was not given the bulk of it. And people thought it was because Stan Lee had not sort of stepped in and said, hey, you know, we really should give this back to Jack. And you know, Stan, I think, did as much as he could say, look, we should do what's right here, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, again, according to Jack Kirby, it was not enough. According to a lot of the fans of Jack Kirby and those who kind of are familiar with the fight, they didn't think it was enough. And maybe it wasn't. And like Mark just said, you know, Stan Lee was remorseful about that. He regretted that had happened. But, you know, it's a tough business. It is a tumultuous business. And just the fact that he was able to have such, you know, for the most part, a positive collaboration with so many different artists, you know, just speaks to how probably collaborative he was. I think Stan was very collaborative and enjoyed the act of collaboration. But you know, I certainly don't put him in the same camp as, with all due respect, Bob Kane, who was like, you know, I created Batman. Batman's mine. I created Batman. Nobody else did. I don't think that
when in fact we know that to not be true.
In fact, I suggest there's a great documentary called Me and Bill Finger we saw it on Hulu. It's absolutely worth watching. It lets you know all of Bill Finger's contributions, who was the co-creator of Batman and the co-creator of the Joker and the co-creator of some of the greatest elements of the Dark Knight mythos that are out there. I don't think it was quite that way. I mean, people know the contribution of Jack Kirby to everything that Jack Kirby was attached to, and I think Stan was the first person to talk about Jack Kirby's amazing contribution to this sort of thing. His feud was more the art. He wanted to get his art back, and he was not able to.
Stan was not a perfect man, but he was a man, and he was a man like all of us. We do have shared emotions and experiences, and I like to think of Stan as being one of these guys that appreciated his life and was able to reflect on the idea that he was loved in his lifetime. That's huge. Many people don't know the appeal or the effect they have on people in their lifetime until, you know, when they die, they don't know. That's but true. Stan was aware. He knew what he did, and he made he made all the time in the world for his fans. He married Joan Bucock in 1947, and the couple they were married 69 years when she passed away in June of 2017. So that's a huge deal for me. They had one child, a daughter, Joan Lee. They had another child, Jan Lee, who died 3 days after her delivery in 53. But they only had the one surviving daughter between the two of them. And then, of course, Joan had passed away. So Stan made time for his family, made time for his personal life. But he seemed to always be available to us. Now, I personally have never met Stan Lee. However, I do believe that some of my fellow gentlemen nerds may be able to share a story.
I do want to hear Mark's story. I never met the man. I saw him at a distance at a convention once. But Mark has a fantastic story about meeting Stan Lee.
You're both very kind. I don't think it's very good, but I do think it's absolutely indicative. And I love the fact that I have a story for this, which is great. It was my first comic convention, 1986. I'm at a Dallas Fantasy Fair, and Stan was one of the guests of honor. I was running everywhere. I was a wild-eyed kid. You know, I had not seen any of this. And so it was all new to me. And I wasn't quite up on the etiquette. When I literally, he breezed by me in the midst of an entourage. And it was literally like a Hudsucker proxy thing where he's got all these people around him and they're all saying stuff, you know, and it's just really kind of weird, but it was a weird deal because I felt the molecules go by me and it was like 3, 2, 1, that was Stan Lee, you know?
Right.
And so I turned and I realized they were getting on the elevator and I should have. For like a half a second, I thought I shouldn't do this. I thought, no, I may not get to see him again. Yeah. And so I said, Stan, can I have your autograph? And he didn't even hesitate. He stepped back out of the elevator with that kind of jaunty, you know, half of he had kind of a strut, you know, always did. And he takes about 5 steps to get to me, and the closer he gets, the bigger his smile gets.
Yeah.
And he took the pen and he took the paper and he said, "Absolutely not." Wrote his name down and handed it back. And I looked over his shoulder and I could see everybody in the elevator and they've all got this, oh geez, not this again. Look on their face, you know, like not only has this been happening all weekend, this always happens.
Yep. Come on, man. You're walking with Stan Lee.
That's exactly right. You knew the job was dangerous when you took it, Fred, you know? And so,
it reminds me of a lot of Forry Ackerman and that same style of reacting to people who come up to him.
Yes.
He has the same, you know, the practice stories, the big warm smile, come here, you know, what do you, absolutely, you know, whatever.
You know, he was Dracula's ring.
The whole practice thing, you know, nice. I will sign it for 1,000 rupees, you know, like, oh God, that's brilliant. But, you know, he made you feel good. And that's that's a brilliant statement to Stan. And I'm sure so many others out there listening to us who've had Stan experiences probably share the same kind of moments.
I'm gonna take a half second to talk about my friend Mark Andrako, who the Stan Lee story was the same thing. And again, this just illustrates Stan. Andrako was on a panel with him at San Diego doing something, and it was I think before the panel. Where he got a second with Stan, he was sitting right next to him or something. And he leaned in and said, "I just wanted to thank you for my childhood. I mean, you know, everything that I learned about right and wrong was from reading Marvel Comics. Thank you so much." Without missing a beat, Stan leaned back and said, "You're welcome. And I take checks." You know, there you go. But that was, man, that was him. And I love the fact that right now the internet is just being flooded with people telling their Stanley story and sharing their Stanley pictures. And it's not just us. There's if you go look at the if you're following any of the Marvel guys from the cinematic universe, all of them are sharing their Stanley pictures of them with Stan, and they've all got this look on their face like, look who I'm standing next to, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. Every single one of them is just delighted.
Chris Evans shaking his hand with the American flag in the background is one of the things that is such a classic. And let's talk real briefly, because we're running out of time. Maximilian, that son of a bitch, is giving us the red eye. A lot of people don't really know him from the comics. A lot of new generation people just know him as the guy from the cameos. Right. And those cameos, they became so indelible and important to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It was very much like my experience of reading the comics and hearing Stan's voice. People watching the movies and seeing him and hearing his voice, but seeing him, it became so indelible to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's so important to that. Yes. He has indeed filmed his cameos for the new Avengers Infinity War Part 2. He's already done that. I think he's filmed his cameo. Yes, he has. That's been reported. He's also done his cameo for Captain Marvel. We'll see him there. And I believe also the Spider-Man, the new Spider-Man movie, which probably will be his final cameo. Now, mind you, in the world of, hey, let's bring Peter Cushing back to life as Grand Moff Tarkin, why wouldn't, and I have nothing against this. If they decide to go this way, I'm all for it. If they want to digitally bring Stan back in every friggin' Marvel movie to the end of time.
And just wears Waldo his ass in every crime.
Totally. Oh, I'm in. Bring it. Yeah. He died at the age of 95 at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles on November 12th, 2018. That person who helps others simply because it should or must be done and because it is the right thing to do is indeed, without a doubt, a real superhero. Excelsior. That's Stan Lee, my friends. Yeah. That's exactly that boils it for me. I love that quote. I love his attitude towards it. And I think the world is a better place because I don't want to say the world is sadder because he's gone. The world's not as good anymore. I want to take all that back. The world is a better place because Stan Lee was in it.
Yes.
The world's a better place for him having been in it. Absolutely. And think about it. For everyone who especially fellow artists, you know, he has achieved the only form of immortality that can be achieved. And as long as his works endure, he'll never be forgotten.
Yeah.
And you know, again, I think we said at the beginning of the show, to have contributed 1/100th of what Stan has contributed to the world, you know, what a happy man I would be. He will always be in our hearts. And every time, like I'm reading through the Fantastic Four right now, the rereads, and you know, Stan is in every one of those pages. Yeah. As long as a kid somewhere will pick up a comic, whether it's an actual physical comic or who knows in the future, it's their little VR helmet comics. then Stan's there. Stan's with them, you know.
I like to think that, especially as the Marvel Cinematic Universe has continued to utilize him, to me, he's taken on a quality that's very similar to what Rod Serling became to the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
This sort of spectral guardian, patron saint, you know, if you will. Yeah. Initially, they would put him in just as a tribute. But then after a while, it became sort of like, no, we have to include Rod, you know. And because it's just not a Twilight Zone, you know, reboot or relaunch or whatever if we don't have him. And so, you know, in the way that Stan used to introduce the comics, much in the same way that Serling would introduce Twilight Zone and Night Gallery. Yeah. I think that he is going to live on in perpetuity, because, you can't take him out of them now. You know, his voice is in there. He's in the creative DNA. He's on the printed page. He's immortalized in film. So there's really not a better tribute for a guy who lived the best years of his life in the public eye. I think that's absolutely the way that he would want to be remembered. And so, while we are sad because he has passed, you have to celebrate that life gleefully lived with some of the greatest characters in the world having all of these fantastic adventures. Yeah. We should all be so lucky.
Amen to that. Yeah. And I'm gonna run on that, because that's, as usual, Mr. Finn, you are a gentleman. The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and is written by Aaron DiArrive, Mark Finn, Ben Gibbs, Joseph Fortinos, with additional material provided by Jack King Kirby. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds mascot created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender tonight was The Fulcrum. Look it up, folks. Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs. Our executive producer, and the man we all pray never get superpowers, is Aaron DiArrive. Aaron DiArrive and Joseph Otinos both have the blood of impunity. And Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher DiArrive. Join us in the Lobot Lounge when next we open. And please, always remember, tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. I'm Joseph Otinos, reminding you to make mine marvel. And Red Skull lives.
Oh man, that was good. I kind of needed that. I got to be honest with you. You know,
the influence he had on all our lives, guys. I mean, we wouldn't be who we are, without that influence.
That's down.
You know, I am.